Hey yo, and here we go. Another episode of We Talk Music is on the air and in your ear. I am Mo, joined once again by the King of the Casters, Mr. Brett Podcast over here. But Brett, we often say that we are honored to have a guest on, but in this case, I don't know that that really covers it. The following gentleman is a member of the Order of Canada, the Canadian Country Music Hall of Fame is among his accolades. His music has truly touched a nation from coast to coast. He's on here to tell us about an evening at the Glenn Gould Studios for Voices That Care. And we are extremely honored to have on Murray McLaughlin. Hello, Murray.
How are you, Mo and Brent? Nice talking to you.
Oh, we are. Well, I mean, as Mo said, I mean, we are truly honored to have you on. You've, you know, you've spoken to so many people with your music, and so for us, it's just we're very pleased to have you on.
Well, be very careful. You know, like Sandra Hull put it really well on Saturday Night Live. That, you know, when Canadians sense that people are starting to say nice things about them, they just run for the nearest mouse hole.
Well, in that case, we should say nice things about other Canadians and talk about the Voices That Care musical evening, because honestly, it sounds so amazing. And I mean, what a great, you know, what a great event, and just, you know, to be able to help out the folks with the complex care and life threatening.
It's a fantastic event. This is the fourth one that I've put together. And of course, the wonderful lady I know well and has actually eaten at my house, a woman who likes to poke things with a sharp stick and get it moving, funny as hell between songs and serious when she sings, Jan Arden is coming to join us, and she was very gracious to do that. Obviously, you know, her mother passed away recently, and their mother had dementia, and Jan wrote that wonderful book, Feeding Mom, so... It was certainly a good fit. The event itself is a fundraiser for an organization that I'm on the board of. It's called the Room 217 Foundation. Excuse me. It's been up and running for about a decade now. And it began as an organization that created musical products and training in their use and training in applications of music for... end-of-life and palliative care situations, and then eventually branched out to the use of music for relieving suffering in Alzheimer's and dementia, or even in cases where there's Parkinsonism or brain injury, those kinds of things. So I got really involved in the idea of it some time ago. I actually had to review a book by a guy named Oliver Sacks, who I'm sure you're familiar with. It was a book called Musicophilia. And I found out through that research that I was astonished to find out that music and the lyrics that are associated with it are stored in a different part of the brain from normal speech, memory, or cognitive functions. So in other words, if there's a deterioration in brain function, music is the last thing to go.
Wow.
So here you have a situation where, like, if a person is experiencing, for instance, a form of dementia, you know, who are you except the sum total of your experiences and memories? And if those things become elusive or are lost to you, the sense of loss of self is terrifying. So what music can do is it can suddenly jolt, create a pathway, if you will, to a time and a memory and other memories associated with that, that brings you back to who you are for a period of time, and it's immensely reassuring. So what the Voices That Care event is for is a fundraiser to put a particular singing program called Pathways that we've developed into adult daycare centers across Canada. And these are places where, you know, if you need to basically park your loved one for a few hours so you can just have a rest from caregiving or you know, just get some shopping done, it's a place where generally you can put them safely for a few hours, but these places generally don't have great budget and they don't generally have anything in the way of programs. So what our singing program does is it's a group program, and people gather together to sing, and it's very, very effective. They actually do it. The staff love it. oxytocin, which is, as you know, the birth chemical that bonds mothers and babies when children are born, and also occurs when people sing together. So you suddenly get people remembering, coming out of themselves, suddenly talking to each other where they didn't do so before, feeling less anxiety. It has an amazing effect when people sing together. So that's principally what this is for.
How, I mean, with your Rolodex of people, like, do you have to, like, turn people down to come onto this program or for the event?
No, are you kidding? Whenever you ask anybody for a favor, you have to go and hunt them. No, I mean, seriously, generally, people have been really wonderful. You know, in the past, I've had, Margaret Atwood came along, for instance, and my great delight is always to have somebody do something that they're not normally known for, so I got Margaret Atwood to sing. You know, she brought the place down. She had a 5-minute standing ovation. Ben Hettner did Boogie Woogie, and you know, I had a wonderful tap dancer up from Soul Pepper Theater. All kinds of different folks over the years have come. Like Jim Cuddy was in our first year. You know, all kinds of folks have come and done it. Been very gracious to do so.
Going to bring Lunch at Allen's along.
Well, eventually, I think that would be a really nice idea. Lunch at Allen's, you know, we tour every year. This year, Lunch at Allen's is kind of taken up. We're doing a big concert in Toronto for food banks, so you know, Lunch at Allen's kind of committed for that, plus the touring activities that we got. And I'll be touring myself in June, actually, out west, but sweet. That's another story.
Well, that's great, because we'd love to see you. We're in Calgary, of course, so... That would be excellent to have you come here.
Well, I actually recently was at the Jack Singer Auditorium right there in Calgary. Not too long ago, I guess, but maybe 8 months ago, something like that. And it was a love-in. I had a great time.
And there's, of course, an excellent guest lineup for this show that has been announced. And will there be, in addition to Jan Arden, of course, is Gavin Crawford and...
Gavin's Gavin's a well-known comedian and also a host of a radio show on CBC Radio. We have Lila Bialy, who just won the Juno Award for her efforts as a jazz singer. She's wonderful, wonderful. I'm going to play myself, of course, and there'll be a little bit of a musical surprise in the way that I present myself. We have an actor. I think people are pretty familiar with him. His name's Ken Welsh, and Ken, of course, was in Twin Peaks, and he played Kate Blanchett's dad in the movie The Aviator. You know, people have seen him in all kinds of stuff. But he's also going to do something that I think, you know, I'm not good. No spoiler alert here. He's going to do something that I think will sort of surprise people. And it's a great delight to me.
And you managed to get Denise Donlan in, so that's quite a coup. Congratulations on that one, your lovely wife.
Well, you know, she's an immensely capable person. I think I'm the luckiest guy on the planet. She's an immensely capable and generous and wonderful person who, you know, makes me look like a punter, basically. You know, she's just really come back from... Jordan, by way of Dubai. She was in Jordan doing a documentary film on the Syrian refugee camps for an organization called War Child. So she's out there, you know, saving the planet, as she always has.
That must be something. I mean, what a couple. Yeah, she's out there saving the planet, and you're helping the Canadians.
The irony was that we were on opposite sides of the world at the same time, because at the same time she was in Jordan, I was off in Vietnam, all the way from the Mekong up to Hanoi for 2 weeks, just to kind of checking out Vietnam. It's a long story, but I really had a yen to go there and explore it.
Yeah, I saw that on your website that you were in Vietnam. Very interesting.
Yeah, it really was. It was a mind-blowing trip.
Is that exploring it? Is that just a search for knowledge? A trip like that, is that something you're looking to interpreted to your music? Is it what's kind of the genesis behind the wish to travel and see these places that let's face it, many of us don't get the chance opportunity to see.
Well, I have an immense curiosity about all kinds of things. I'm curious about science, about astronomy, about meteorology, about politics, about music, about history. I also am a firm believer that as much as I love Canada, and I do, that you have to get out of it from time to time to gain some perspective and some understanding about what the rest of the world is like, and also that it allows you to reappreciate your country in many ways when you return, in spite of the occasional experience of trying to get back in through the grim-faced border official.
So it happens to everybody, even a member of the Order of Canada, okay?
Oh, God, yeah, I know. It's like, if you have any kind of a lingering fear of authority, you immediately get lip sweat in the lineup.
Well, the last flight I was on, as we were landing, coming out of Toronto to Calgary here, there was a scorpion on it, so...
Really? You got that one?
Yeah, I was on that one. So not much is going to change. Yeah, not much is going to match that for a surreal experience.
Actually, Denise has got you beat. She's got you beat one. She was on flight back from, from Bombay. This is last year. She went to India, to Bhutan, actually, but was flying back from Bombay. And two seats away from her, the guy died.
Oh, wow.
So the last 5 or 6 hours into the city, this guy was basically sitting in his chair with him. They actually unrolled, this is kind of awful, but they sort of they unrolled his head covering, his turban, and draped it over him.
Oh my goodness.
And they weren't going to let the people off the plane until the coroner came on and pronounced the guy. And then they quickly realized that, well, that's really not a good idea, because by that point the person was kind of in a sitting position semi-permanently as the stiffness. So they got all the people off the plane before they got the guy off the plane. Let's put it that way.
Now that is an amazing experience. I think she and I can both agree with the one thing that you never want to hear in the plane that I heard, and she might have that day is there a doctor in the house? Those are not the words that you ever want to hear when you're on a plane.
There's one sentence that's worse.
What's that?
If there's a doctor in the house, could you please come to the flight deck?
Oh, yeah. That would be worse. You know what? Well put.
Yupper.
You know what?
Anyway, so that didn't mean I wasn't like one-upping. It was just kind of an interesting story, really.
Yeah, that is absolutely. You know, it's as we talk to you. You know, one of the things that certainly impresses me, or is impressed upon me about talking to you and listening to your music, is that you are not somebody who easily is pigeonholed. You kind of defy expectations. For instance, we say you're a member of the Order of Canada. And the Canadian Country Music Hall of Fame, but certainly not what people consider to be a typical, stereotypical country musician, as an example. Do you kind of understand why people want to label musicians, or do you think that it's not truly a fair way to assess people's music?
I don't think it's a good idea. I mean, most of the people, myself included, I listen to a wide variety of music, and my only criteria is, does it involve me emotionally, and or is it good, and do I respect the playing? And a lot of younger people that I know are also like that. What bothers me sometimes is that, and maybe it's a function of marketing, I'm not sure, the tendency to tribalize music or as a cultural thing, put it into silos. In other words, if you like country music, why can't you like jazz? Or if you like Claude Debussy, why can't you also like roots music? for? You know, why does it have to be like you're a member of a political party or a cult or something? You know, it's, I think it's been a function probably of commercial marketing in the music business and possibly in the other media industries, you know, the radio business, for instance, as it was, probably not as it is. You know, you had a top 40 station, you had country stations, you had a adult contemporary or whatever they're calling it this week, and they would attract a specific group of people based on their imaging. And I guess that's kind of stuck, you know.
Now, when you're writing songs, when you're writing them, do you kind of, you know, put a bunch in a one container where it's just like, oh, these fit well together, and then I have some that maybe don't fit well with others, and then when it's time to record another album, do you just kind of see what you're feeling, or do you kind of write just the songs that are going to go on that album?
The short answer to that question is yes, but not the last part. Interestingly enough, I mean, the idea of an album now seems to be generally regarded as kind of quaint. You know, people don't really, God, I hate this word, they don't consume music that way anymore. They generally are song-oriented, or they hear something, or they'll get a snippet or a three, or they'll download it from Spotify or iTunes or whatever. So the idea of actually curating an album where you put a specific run of songs together as a performance, going, yeah, look, this is a nice thing. Let's sustain this mood for a while and do a change up here, blah, which, you know, I actually do. I still do that, but I don't think a lot of people really concern themselves with it that much anymore. I think there really aren't that many album artists. I mean, Drake sure isn't an album artist. He's like a, you know, whatever he is. I mean, it's enormously successful, but it sure ain't that.
Yeah, like a singles machine kind of thing where you release an album, but you could also release every single one of them as a single, I think.
Yeah, you know, it's, I'm not trying to play like an old card or anything, but generally speaking, the way that the whole system of creating, you know, people of the ilk of, say, a Justin Bieber or a Taylor Swift or a Drake, I have no idea how that works. I really, zero, none, I have no idea.
So as somebody who's been in, you know, all over the country, and truly you have managed to see Canada, what is it that kind of, do you believe, ties together Canadians besides hockey? What is a trait that you think is most, no matter what part of the country you go to, most kind of ties the people together?
Sometimes it seems what ties them together is their ability to squabble. But there is a characteristic, I think, that Canadians have. You know, I've sort of made the observation over the years that, you know, oddly enough, Canadians are more like Russians than they are like Americans. And, you know, we've produced cultural artists and artifacts, you know, that, I guess, to trot out the old cliche, you know, the Joanies or the Neils or the Gordons or the Leonards of the world. But they are kind of a uniquely sort of Canadian product. They have a sound and a sensibility to what they do, and I think that's still ongoing. And the best way to describe it that I ever heard was from a Japanese university student when I was touring in Japan. And he was trying to make the point that, you know, Canadian music was different from the music that comes from the United States. And I said, well, you know, yeah, but, you know, because it's heavily influenced. What do you mean? And he said, a wind blows through it.
Wind blows through
and
it.
And I went, yeah. And I went, I think I know exactly what he means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this sense, I mean, we as Canadians, we live in this country like a tick lives on the back end of a hound. Basically, you know, it kind of tolerates us. And I think that informs our thinking. I think there's, you know, there's a lack of arrogance in the Canadian psyche, which I think is what begets our much internationally renowned sense of apologetic humility. But I think that's a good thing. And I think it's a really good path forward for us as a nation, as we the other work that we have to do, I think it's going to serve us really well.
One of the things that I was interested in as I was reading through Voices That Care and stuff like that is like how important, how awesome is it, I guess, for you to have, you know, in your career developed a name that you're able to create and to give back like this?
It's an absolutely tremendous opportunity. I make no bones about it, and I have a very strong feeling that it's part of my makeup. I feel that if your country, if your society has been good to you and rewarded you, then it's up to you to give it back and pay it forward. And I've always felt that way, and I'm absolutely delighted that Bev Foster, who actually founded this organization, came and talked to me those years ago and helped me drink the Kool-Aid.
So as we carry on, like after this and stuff like that, you said you were going to tour. Do you think because your last album, I think, was 2017? And
Love Can't Tell Time was, I guess, yeah, it was. Gosh, it's a year and change old.
Now,
where is the time, though?
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously, I'm sure you're very busy, so you must it must kind of fly by. Do you anticipate more more albums in the coming years then?
I don't plan on it, and I don't anticipate it, but they seem to happen anyway. I thought when I finished the album Human Rights, and it really was. It was actually quite well received in a lot of other places besides Canada. I thought, boy, that's about the best I could do. And I think as a songwriter, I think I hit my dinger there. And so I wasn't really thinking about making another record after Human Rights. I thought, well, that's that. But done. Move on. And then maybe as a result of living in Italy and sort of falling in love with playing the guitar again, this vain desire to just want to be able to play like Freddie Green in the Basie Orchestra, I started kind of relearning a whole bunch of stuff I'd forgotten and then working on stuff that I'd never tried before on the guitar. And the result was I found out that I could play a lot of that kind of stuff. And so I started kind of working up old songs that I loved, and then found out that I could actually play stuff that I'd particularly written for a project, and voila, it became that Love Can't Tell Time album. It was driven as a little bit as a vanity project, because I just wanted to thumb my nose and go, well, see, I really can play the guitar. the project's kind of evolved. Even while I was recording that album and finishing it up, I wasn't really sure that it was going to go out. I was kind of doing it for just the sheer love of doing it. But I really, there's albums you make that you don't really listen to anymore, but both Human Rights and Love Can't Tell Time are albums that I put them on and I listen to them and I go, yeah, that's cool, I like that.
Do you still write songs constantly? Is that something that that just never leaves? It's just kind of ingrained?
It's like a carbuncle. Every so often it rises up and you have to lance it. There's an old prejudice in the songwriting business that you can't write songs when you're happy. Not true. There's another kind of old saw that says you really have to keep office hours. Get up in the morning, sit down, and write. Also not true. I mean, you write when you have something to say or there's something that needs to come out of you. But I do have the discipline now to call up my friend Gary Furness, who runs Sony ATV Publishing. He has these, I call them the rubber rooms over his offices. They're like little songwriters, but they're soundproof. So I go in there and I close the big steel door with the little window in it so they can look in and see if you're dead. And it's so quiet that you can literally hear the blood rushing through your veins in there. And it's like, do you remember isolation tanks?
Yep.
It's like that. So you're so devoid of stimulus that your brain starts to decide that it has to entertain you because nothing's going on. And suddenly all this weird stuff stuff comes out. And you write it, and you write it down. That's my method now.
Wow. And I was wondering, if I was to go to Allen's and get lunch, what would you recommend I get off the menu?
Well, I mean, if you're lunching at Allen's on the Danforth, which is actually owned by a wonderful man by the name of John Maxwell, and who, by the way, has a PhD in Arabic studies, just for your edification, I would always recommend the omelet with your optional fries or your salad. Usually, it's a really good omelet. It's got, you know, spinach and goat cheese, and it's pretty healthy go. If you're not an omelet person, one of the best go-tos is sometimes it's not even on the menu, but they always have like a really amazing New York style bacon cheese burger with fat New York style fries. If you're really having an arterially clogging, lusty moment, that's the go-to.
I have that usually at least once a day. That moment, not that burger.
Yeah, that burger sounds like it would definitely fix that moment.
For that day.
It's a burger that is reminiscent of, like back in the day when I used to play Bitter End in New York, there was a cafe next door called Rienzi's. It's long gone, but Rienzi's made those thick, enormously fat, thick New York cut fries and huge fat burgers. And that's the first place I ever had something like that. And the one in Allen's is exactly like the ones from Rienzi's.
Tremendous. And of course, Lunch in Allen's, that's you, Mark Jordan, Ian Thomas, Cindy Church. So just wanted to make sure that people were aware we hadn't mentioned the other names in the group with you. So once again, it's Thursday, April 25th. I may have said at the beginning of the show, April 15th, because we were talking about a show we went to that we're scheduled to go to on the 15th immediately before talking to you. So I do want to get that out there once again, that the Voices of the Care event is April 25th.
Oh, yeah. Thursday, April the 25th, yes. At the Glenn Gould Theater in Toronto. It's going to be a fabulous night. It really will. I'm not sure if there's a ton of tickets left, but if there is, go get one, because they're going very, very quickly, and I think they're almost done.
And that's great. I mean, wonderful, wonderful cause. And yeah, is there ever any thought of, like, live streaming the event?
I'd have to find somebody really smart to figure out how to monetize that so it would benefit the organization, because it's, you know, it's a benefit at the end of the day.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess there would have to be some sort of crowdfunding element or something like that. I don't know how they would monetize it, but that's an interesting idea.
Just, you know, as you describe the things that that people are going to do and stuff like that, I mean, I'll admit, like, I would love to be there and I would love to see some of that stuff. So I would be more than willing to pay for a live stream of that.
Exactly. You know, I guess the other thing that would be have to be considered would be, you know, there are a number of people who are on stage on the event, and, you know, you'd have to secure the rights for broadcast for all of those people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, so there's probably elements of complication involved in that. But, you know, it's not out of the question for sure.
Well, I know we've you've been so generous with your time. I'd love it if you could leave us with just, when you think about your life in the music industry, you know, what are some of the things that make you the happiest?
Well, that's a very, very easy answer. The happiest I am is when I'm playing music. that's it. The second happiest I am is when I write something and it's done and I can't wait to go and play it for folks, because I just feel like I got it right.
That's wonderful. Thank you, Murray, once again for your time. This has been really educational for me. I feel like I've learned an awful lot and really enjoyed this chat. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much for talking to me, and thanks for helping with folks knowing about the 217 Voices of Care concert. I appreciate it very much.
Oh, well, you know, it's our pleasure. I mean, this is one of our ways that we can give back. So, Murray McLaughlin, thank you so much. Voices That Care, April 25th. If you're into the Toronto area, buy a ticket.
this guy since I met you. Since you found it in your heart to say I do. Some guys might think they got it made, caught up in the social world. I know I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I'm the luckiest guy, and that's a fact. One look at you convinced me I could not turn back. You'd stand right out in any crowd of Thoroughbred City girls. I know I'm the luckiest guy in the world. Oh, you're strong but gentle, sentimental, not for sale, even rental. Simply transcendental. You're strong but gentle, sentimental, not for sale, even rental, simply transcendental. I'm the luckiest guy anyone can see, though they wonder what it is that you see in me. I don't question my good fortune, come on, give my heart a twirl. I know I'm the luckiest guy, I know I'm the luckiest guy, I know I'm the luckiest guy in the world.